Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting this program. You can find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin on our website. Just go to kfuo.org and look for the sponsor section. Joining me in the studio today, Terry Schmidt, Director of LCMS School Ministry in the LCMS Office of National Mission. Terry, welcome to Faith and Family.
And thank you very much. Glad to be here this morning.
And also joining me in studio today, the Reverend Bart Day, Director of LCMS Office of National Mission. Bart, welcome to Faith and Family.
Hey, good morning. Great to be with you again.
Joining us by phone today, Gregory S. Baylor, Senior Counsel and Director of Center for Religious Schools at the Alliance Defending Freedom. Greg, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thanks, Andy. Great to be with you.
Glad to have you with us today. Looking forward to sharing with our guests, or with our listeners today, about what's going on in schools, Christian schools. What are the issues that Christian schools are facing today? Let's start with our Lutheran schools. Terry, tell us a little bit about Lutheran schools today in the United States, the LCMS schools.
Yes, we have a very vibrant group of schools. We have about 2,000 Lutheran schools located all across our country. Three classifications: early childhood centers, elementary schools, and high schools. Actually, the fact is that there are 2,068 schools operating under the banner of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We have about 191,000 students who are enrolled in those schools. That school year has just concluded. And we have a total of almost 20,000, 19,938 teachers who serve in those schools. They just concluded another school, a great school year. Several of our schools are still open until the middle of June. Those poor folks will be suffering through for another couple of weeks before they conclude their school year. But it's been a great year for Lutheran schools.
Well, very good. Very good. Greg, tell us a little bit about your work with Alliance Defending Freedom.
Sure. Well, Alliance Defending Freedom is a Christian organization, Christian legal organization that builds an alliance in order to keep open the door for the spread of the gospel. We're involved in legal advocacy for religious liberty, for sanctity of life, for marriage and the family. I am one of the religious liberty folks here at ADF. I've been an attorney since 1990, and I've been doing full-time public interest religious freedom work since 1994. I've been with ADF since 2009, and in the last couple of years, I was denominated the director of our Center for Religious Schools, which really reflects ADF's commitment to preserving and protecting the religious freedom of Christ-centered educational institutions, both K through 12 and at the higher ed level. So I've had a long association with Christian educational institutions. I served for a time on the board of the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, now serve as their religious liberty consultant, work frequently with ACSI and AACS, some of these K through 12 associations, and I'm really delighted to have had opportunities over the years to work with LCMS and its schools.
Greg, what are some of the key issues that you think our schools are facing today?
Well, the number one issue far and away more important than all the others, is the application of non-discrimination rules that impair your ability to be who you are. You don't need me to tell you that an institution maintains its character, maintains its fealty to its faith through the people it hires. If it hires people who reject that faith who reject the moral standards that come with that faith, it quickly becomes something then different than what its founders wanted it to be. And that is precisely what's happening right now, is there's enormous pressure being placed on educational institutions, more at the higher ed level, frankly, but also at the K through 12 level, to relinquish these distinctives. And the distinctive that is most bothersome to those who advocate for these changes in law is our views on marriage and the family, sexuality, and gender. We believe, as morally orthodox Christians, that marriage is a permanent union between one man and one woman. We believe that homosexual behavior is forbidden by Scripture, is immoral, is a sin against God. And we also believe that men and women are categories that God created from the very beginning in the garden, and that although we do acknowledge the existence of the psychological condition called gender dysphoria, many Christians believe that it's inappropriate for someone to try to resolve a difference between their biological sex and what they perceive themselves to be. And when schools and other ministries have policies that reflect these views, what is often said to them is that they're committing discrimination. They say you're committing discrimination on the basis of religion by having religious qualifications for employees or for student admissions. They say you're committing sexual orientation discrimination by having rules not about people's orientation, but about their conduct. And then they say we're committing gender identity discrimination because, consistent with our religious views, we are unwilling to essentially grant every wish that a transgender person makes, to use the what I think is the incorrect locker room or shower facility, live in the incorrect dormitory. So that's the number one threat far and away. The secondary threat is really kind of an old one that still lingers, and that's the idea that religious entities, because of church-state separation, are not entitled to participate in government programs on the government benefit programs on the same terms as other organizations. But the non-discrimination freedom of association thing is by far the most challenging threat that we face today.
Yeah, this is Bart. Thank you, Greg, for that intro. I just wanted to share with our listeners that part of the reason to facilitate the conversation today, and Terry can expound on this, is just the large volume of questions that we continue to get from our Lutheran school administrators. And I'm not talking higher ed in the universities, and perhaps if we want to foray into talking about the Concordia University system in the second hour, we can do that. But we're getting more and more questions from our elementary and high school administrators about, you know, what do we do? What is the entanglement? What about these anti-discrimination policies? What about our participation in receiving the funding? And ADF has been a great partner. And one of the things that I wanted to make sure we share today is that ADF published a document called Protecting Your Ministry. That's been out for a little while. That circulated among a lot of Lutheran schools, but they would always call us and say, it's an ADF document. We're not sure if that's an LCMS document. Should we use this? So we need our listeners and our administrators and pastors to know that we have just finished co-branding a new kind of edition of Protect Your Ministry. That will be mailed to every congregation and school in the Synod the middle part of July. ADF is going to be at the Synod Convention this summer, and they will actually have copies of that available. We will then make that available for download. But that document talks about statements and materials and information that is very helpful both for churches and for schools. So statements on religious beliefs, statements about marriage, gender, sexuality, who has final authority in a church and school on these issues. Talks about employment criteria, facility usage policies, memberships policies, marriage policies, all of these questions that we continue to get. So please, listeners, know that we are hearing from you to the Board of Directors of Synod, to the Office of President, to our Office and National Mission, of questions and concerns on any number of fronts. And we're really hopeful that the document will be a helpful first step in people talking with their local legal counsel, certainly, but then having some sample statements and thinking through those issues, because the ADF document is great. It also shares some actual real-life stories of lawsuits and things that are happening where people thought there wasn't an issue, and then all of a sudden there was an issue. So it's really a great timely piece today to talk with Greg about this more fully for our Lutheran schools, because there are just an awful lot of questions, and the most helpful information that we can get in our people's hands, the better equipped they will be able to continue to do ministry, to do that vibrantly, faithfully. We don't need to close our Lutheran schools. We don't need to be afraid, but we need to be very wise and make sure that we're taking the precautions we need, as Greg said, specifically so that we can hire and call those faculty members who we need, who are teaching in our schools, our administrators, making sure that we're being faithful to the gospel, that we're spreading that to the very ends of the earth in a helpful way that keeps us legally protected. So thank you to everybody for the conversation
today. Just a little more insight on the document, Protect Your Ministry, which is a tremendous document. One of the big differences, I actually secured a copy of that document in meetings with ASCI school leaders. One of the big differences between a non-denominational ASCI school and a Lutheran school is most of your non-denominational schools are covenant schools. That means that the people that they enroll, the families that they enroll, are very active and have to pledge the fact and sign off that they are actively engaged in a church body. Lutheran schools, most of our Lutheran schools are very different because they're evangelical in their outreach. And so if a family comes in and expresses the fact that they aren't Christian, we almost say, come on, we'd love to have you, but you have to understand what we believe and what we teach and where that comes from. And we're very clear about what their children are going to hear. And if their children are willing, if those families are willing to participate, we see that as an awesome tool to lead these children and families to Jesus.
Absolutely. What are, Terry, being out in the schools so frequently and interacting with so many schools, so many administrators, what are some of the top questions that that you receive from schools, school administrators, teachers, even parents?
It almost always defers to the facts or the situation of the day. It's almost a situation of the day. In other words, this changes weekly and monthly. The questions that come to us right now, majority of the questions that we're receiving are related to the overtime rules that were just passed. But it seems that there are so many things that are changing so rapidly, from the from who we hire to how we use our facilities to how we the transgender issue, and then all the way to the overtime rules that have just been mandated from the federal government. And all of these things impact our schools. So the same schools are calling with different questions. Week by week, the questions change, and we're scrambling to find answers behind the fact. If we could get some idea about what's coming down the track, that we could be prepared before the questions actually hit us with the answers, we'd feel better equipped.
Greg, what are some of the questions that that you receive at ADF from schools, from school administrators or parents that that you're addressing today?
Yeah, they tend to come in two categories. There are some schools that are trying to get out in front, and they ask what they can do now before the controversy arises. And we love it when that happens. It's much easier to try to navigate what your position, what your response is going to be to a particular situation before it actually comes up, rather than to kind of make it up on the fly or have to respond under time sensitivity. Most of the inquiries that come to us have to do with this non-discrimination problem that I discussed earlier. There's a recognition, a correct recognition among so many schools that this is a threat that is not only in the future, but it's here now. And schools want to be able to equip themselves to prepare for that. And we obviously, the first piece of advice that we give them is to get a hold of that copy, a copy of that Protecting Your Ministry guide, and to the extent that's appropriate for your particular institution, to adopt the recommendations that are put forth in there. I think that makes a lot of sense because it does a couple of things. Number one, it reaffirms your commitment to orthodoxy. I have less concern, frankly, about the LCMS schools than some of the others, but it always is helpful to write down what you believe. Even as it becomes culturally controversial, it kind of plants a stake in the ground, and that's good. The second thing is that it educates the internal community. I've seen problems arise where the top of an organization understands what the policies and rules are, and people further down the chain do not, and that creates problems. So that's another benefit that it has. The third benefit that it has, and this sort of advice has, is that it really puts people on notice. In other words, I'm talking about parents and students. We don't want to hide the ball or sandbag anybody with respect to the character of the school and its views on controversial issues like marriage and sexuality. It is a good thing to not hide that, but to highlight it appropriately within the context of your entire Christian character. I always say that people are more likely to create a controversy, to maybe go see a lawyer, to maybe file a legal complaint, if they're surprised, if their expectations are disappointed. I think it's much safer to be clear from the beginning who you are. And the last benefit of that is that you can use these statements that you've made in response to any legal controversy that you get into, because your response to this is going to be, well, yes, we do have policies like this, but they're rooted in our faith. Take a look at these documents that we produce well in advance of the current controversy. It helps you in that context. The other category of inquiry we get is they've gotten an application from a student or a family that probably is not able to comply or mesh with community standards, and then they're asking for very specific advice about what precisely they should say in response to an email or a letter or a phone call that they got, and we're happy to do that as well. But I think a lot, like I said, almost all the inquiries these days are about this non-discrimination issue, whether it's religion, sexual orientation, or gender identity.
Greg, this is Bart. I wanted to follow up on something that you just said, and maybe you could unpack this. This is what Terry touched on early. You talked about, let's talk kind of a real-life case here for an LCMS school. You talked about a school having an issue when they receive an application and it doesn't seem that they can comply with the standard of the school. But that really goes to this sort of covenant type school, evangelical schools, where parents are asked to sign on to this statement of Christian faith and morality, which is simply not the case in most LCMS schools. In fact, I don't know of any. So that admission policy, we are accepting non-Christians. We are accepting all sorts of people from the community into our school to give them an excellent education that's thoroughly Christian and inundated with the gospel. So what would be the distinction there, or how should Lutheran schools handle those kind of things where a couple comes to your school and they're a same-sex couple and they have their child and they want to come in? Maybe they actually can comply if they understand the teaching of the church and they're happy with that and accepting that those are, you know, this is going to be the moral stance of the school and the way instruction is going to go. Do you have any guidance for schools that don't have that sort of covenant-type policy of admission?
Right. I think the first thing to understand is there are not a lot of legal rules that govern the admissions decisions of private schools. Let's set aside for the moment the question of whether Title IX applies to K-12 schools because you receive some form of federal financial assistance. But most states don't have a law that says, private schools, thou shalt not discriminate on the basis of X, Y, and Z. So you've traditionally been able to enjoy the freedom to do what you want to do. And I think different schools will have different answers. Some schools I've encountered are just simply uncomfortable with having a same-sex couple with a child in the school. One of the things that I've heard them say they're concerned about is a lot of schools have heavy parental involvement requirements, and they just simply want to avoid the questions that young students might ask about a same-sex couple. But I don't recommend that to them legally. I think they should do what they think is appropriate and prudent and theologically correct. The only legal thing I would say is you know, just put people on notice. It's something that you said before, Bart, which is just highlighting who we are and this is what we're going to teach and there's going to be no surprises. I think that's the main thing that you can do. But separate from that, I really do believe you do have discretion and you should exercise it in the way that you deem appropriate.
I'd like to go back to something you mentioned just a little bit ago, Greg, about documenting what you believe, how important that is for schools, for churches as well, but documenting what you believe. Can you give me an example of what that might look like?
Sure. A lot of schools will have a statement of faith. Some of them are more complex than others. I suspect that an LCMS statement of faith would be pretty standard. Some of them are just short statements that track with the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed and are really the fundamentals of the Christian faith. Other schools go into more detail and talk about their view of end times or their hermeneutic or things of that more detailed nature. I think one of the questions that you have to ask is whether you want to express your views about marriage and sexuality in the statement of faith itself or in a separate document. I don't think there's a correct legal answer to that. I don't think it's more powerful to put your position on those questions in a statement of faith as opposed to a separate, maybe, you know, board resolution about your views on those questions. And I think some people believe that these issues are not as essential to the Christian faith as, say, the divinity of Christ, the triune nature of God, the authority of the Bible, and all the usual things. So that's the question that they face about where to sort of locate those things. And the second question is, well, okay, you write all these things down on a piece of paper, then what? I mean, what is it for? I think that has to be made clear. I've visited a lot of school websites where they have a statement of faith. I'm like, okay, this is great, this seems right, but what? How does this translate into reality? Who's required to sign off on this? Is it just the board? Is it just the principal? Is it all of the teachers? And obviously, you know, we're talking in the LCMS context, it's probably not parents and students and all of the rest. But there does need to be at least some clarity in the mind of the school about who's required to abide by this statement. The last thing I would say about it is some schools have a practice of an annual reaffirmation. I think that's a good idea. I know it's logistically a hassle to do that every year, but, you know, let's face it, people change their minds about things. And I think an annual reaffirmation is probably a good idea rather than relying on a, you know, a statement or a declaration of agreement with the school's faith that's collecting dust and is 10 or 20 years old.
What is the best way to communicate that document? Where does that need to be made available?
Well, if you're talking about in the employment context, I think it's appropriate to mention right up front, maybe in an abbreviated form. I mean, a lot of organizations, you can go onto their website and there's a careers link that you can click. I think something should be on that very first page that notifies a potential applicant about the identity of the school and the things that may make the school not a particularly good fit for them. It doesn't have to be the whole statement of faith, the whole statement on marriage and sexuality and gender, but maybe a link to it. You might embed it in a non-discrimination statement that you have. I've seen some schools say, we do not discriminate on the basis of, and then they write down the things that they don't discriminate on the basis of, and then they say something like, we, you know, as a religious organization, as a religious school, as a Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod School, we have the legally protected right to make employment decisions based upon our religious views. So I think these kind of signals right at the beginning, I think it's a mistake to wait until you're in the interview or you're at the place where they're ready to sign off on the job offer that you've accepted them. Oh, by the way, here are all of these things. So earlier is better in the employment context. As far as families, you know, again, it's a little different if you're in an evangelistic as opposed to a covenantal environment. But my advice would be pretty similar, which is, you know, don't be shy about this. Talk about who you are right from the beginning and that there are expectations for students and families and they will be taught our particular views on certain controversial issues. And we just, you know, want you to be ready for that and prepared for it.
I'm Andy Bates. You're listening to Faith and Family. We're addressing LCMS schools and the issues they're facing today. We're talking with Gregory Baylor, Senior Counsel and Director of the Center for Religious Schools at Alliance Defending Freedom, the Reverend Bart Day, Director of LCMS Office of National Mission, and Terry Schmidt, Director of School Ministry for the LCMS Office of National Mission. We'll be back in just a minute.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. We are discussing issues that LCMS schools, other Christian schools, are facing today. We're talking with Gregory Baylor, Senior Counsel, the Director of Center for Religious Schools at Alliance Defending Freedom, the Reverend Bart Day, Director of LCMS Office of National Mission, and Terry Schmidt, Director of School Ministry in the LCMS Office of National Mission. Before we went to break, we were talking about a number of things, particularly documents. And while we were in the break, Bart, you brought up a good point of how we can a great resource that we mentioned earlier to help with those documents.
Right, the Protecting Your Ministry document that the LCMS has now done in conjunction with ADF, kind of an LCMS brand of that, is going to be out in the middle of July. And again, has many statements of faith, or those statements of belief, of marriage, of gender, of sexuality, of human life, of final authority in the church and school. So those are there. They're pretty robust. I think that they will be helpful for congregations to and schools to look at, you know, adopting those, using those, putting those in their manuals or whatever that they're sharing. So those resources are going to be available very, very shortly.
It's a great opportunity for our schools to have something that unites us, and something that they don't have to create on their own. This will be available to you. It's an exciting opportunity for our schools.
During the break, Bart, you mentioned the rich history that we have as Lutherans, as a church body. We have this rich history that we can tap into. We don't necessarily have to just create anything out, you know, pull things out of the air or anything like that. Or do we have, we don't have to spend long hours trying to figure out what it is that we believe in and how to articulate that in a document.
Right. The doctrine and the substance and the teaching, the dogmas of the church are there. So unlike some church bodies who maybe don't have a larger affiliation or a synod or as long a history, I think that's not an excuse for us not to be diligent and proactive and seeking legal advice and doing all the things that Greg's telling us to do. But, you know, we do have deep, rich positions on who we are in Christ and our sexual identity and what marriage is. And it's not like we just sort of made this up in the last 15 or 20 years as these issues have been encroaching us into culture. So being able to clearly articulate that in our schools and then being able to reach out with that and that gospel into our communities with the children and family we serve, we think is a great opportunity.
Terry, do you get questions from time to time about schools receiving government funds?
Frequently receive those questions. The big question is, if we take hot lunch federal and we participate in the federally funded hot lunch program, are we taking federal funds? I probably have had that question posed a dozen times in the last 3 weeks.
Greg, I'm sure this is an issue or a topic that you're addressing frequently. What would you like to share with us on that topic?
Well, I think that the answer is probably yes when it comes to the National School Lunch Program. There are a couple of cases that were decided in Pennsylvania within the last 5 or 6 years that address this precise question, whether a school that participates in the National School Lunch Program is a recipient of, quote, federal financial assistance for educational programs and thus is subject to the ban on sex discrimination found in Title IX. So we do have some case law authority. They're both at the district court levels. They have this question hasn't percolated its way up to the courts of appeals and certainly not to the Supreme Court. There are some that believe that these cases are wrongly decided, that you don't get on the hook, so to speak, for Title IX by participating in the National School Lunch Program. But I think given the existence of these two cases about that program, I think the better, more prudent approach is to assume that you are subject to Title IX. And maybe we can talk about what that actually means, especially in the wake of the Department of Justice's directive a few weeks ago.
And Greg, to further complicate the issue, some of our schools take state aid, and then to discern if they are involved in taking, you know, in exactly if busing is often presented to me. We use the local school buses from the community school. Where does that put us?
I think there are a few things to say about state and local aid. The first one is that it does not trigger Title IX non-discrimination obligations. You only are subject to federal Title IX by getting a federal benefit. So that's point number one. Point number two is, I am not aware of any situation where a state or local government has told a private religious school that's participating in a state or local program like this that it must therefore not discriminate on the basis of certain things that would be problematic for the school to comply with, such as religion, sexual orientation, and gender identity. So far, so good. But the last thing I will say about this is that any connection you have with the government, any benefit you get from the government, is a potential place where a non-discrimination string could be attached. So you might be fine now, but let's face it, there are a lot of folks who hold different views on these issues who want to use the leverage of government funding, of government benefits, of government programs in order to pressure schools to change their views and policies and practices on these controversial issues, or if they won't change, to punish them and marginalize them and reduce their effectiveness by stripping them of funding.
Any other questions?
Well, Greg, I wonder if we should go back and unpack more of the Title IX piece then that federal funding. So the state, we don't seem to have the entanglement, at least not yet, maybe could be, but it's not seen that way, or it hasn't, you've not heard of cases. But what about those who are taking Title IX money? And I think it's safe to say that that is a significant number, a significant percentage of Lutheran schools that are. And that's where we're getting the questions. Where do we navigate those waters, and what does that really mean for the discriminatory laws?
Yeah. So let's assume that these two cases are right, and that if you participate in National School Lunch Program or the E-Rate Program, which was also involved in one of those two cases, Let's assume that you are subject to Title IX. What in the world does that mean? Well, it's important to point out that Title IX statute is very straightforward, very simple. It just says if you're a recipient of federal financial assistance, you're an educational institution, the money is for an educational program or activity, you may not discriminate on the basis of sex. And that has largely been uncontroversial when it comes to religious schools and their faith-based policies and practices. Of course, we all know Title IX is the law that is all about athletics and equality in athletics. And obviously that part of it is applicable. But in terms of religious liberty problems, we didn't see too many of those until around 2013. And that's when the Department of Education in Washington, its Office for Civil Rights, started saying that that word sex in Title IX includes gender identity. In other words, there's a ban in Title IX that we didn't know was there all the way back from 1972 that tells schools subject to Title IX that they can't discriminate on the basis of gender identity. So that's a controversial proposition. There have been different court rulings on whether that's a legitimate exercise of the Department of Education's authority. I'm of the view that they went too far and that they exercised a congressional lawmaking function rather than an administrative executive branch function. But let's just assume for the rest of our discussion that that is a legitimate thing, that when the department said sex includes gender identity, that they're allowed to do that. The next question is, well, what does it mean to discriminate on the basis of gender identity? In other words, what are you allowed and not allowed to do? This is where the directive, the guidance, the document that the Department of Education sent out on May 13 of this year becomes important. It is really the first time where the government has explicitly stated what counts as discrimination on the basis of gender identity. There was ambiguity about that question before. One of the questions I always had was, well, what if the school really does a reasonable accommodation of a student who's suffering from gender dysphoria? Suppose they're, you know, maybe willing to use the preferred name. Maybe they're willing to allow the student to use a single-user restroom facility, maybe in the teacher's lounge or something like that. Is that good enough? Is that discrimination in the eyes of the government? And the government gave us its answer on March 13th, and it said, no, that is not good enough. Reasonable accommodations are not good enough. You must treat the person as if they are the gender that they believe themselves to be. And that applies to all kinds of things. I've got the directive in front of me here, and it talks about, you know, the identification documents, the preferred sex, as it were, even if it's contrary to biological sex, has to be on those documents. You have to use the name the person chooses. You have to use the pronouns the person chooses. And then the more controversial and problematic and really, I think, troubling things are, you know, use of facilities that are typically segregated by sex. Locker rooms, showers, changing facilities, restrooms, and the like. It also applies to athletics. So if a strapping 16-year-old young man believes that he is female, you must allow him to play on the female sports teams. So that's what it means to comply with Title IX as interpreted by the Department of Education. Obviously very controversial, a huge uproar. It remains to be seen whether this overreach, in my view, survives the courts. The last question, maybe I should pause before we go to this, is what in the world can you do in response to that? Does that seem like a good place to go next, or did you want to interject?
I think so.
Okay.
I do have a question. I do have a quick question
before. Scared everybody, right?
What does the word identify, you know, as you said, for example, a strapping young male says that he is a female, he has to be then allowed to participate in and play on the female team in sports. What does it mean to identify? Does that mean that this young man simply says that he is a woman, or has documentation from a professional, whether it be a medical or a mental health professional? What does that mean he identifies as a female?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because that's another open question that was unresolved before this May 13th, 2016 guidance. There were even some states, the more liberal states, had gone ahead and say, hey, here's the process for changing your gender. On your birth certificate, you have to maybe take some medical steps with hormone treatments and surgery. Maybe you have to have seen a mental health or medical doctor who's signed off on the fact that you're suffering from gender dysphoria. And those are the prerequisites, in a sense, for making the change on your birth certificate. The other view was that it really just is a matter of total subjectivity. It really is an entirely internal thing. You don't even have to, let's use the male to female example, you don't have to wear clothing traditionally associated with women. You don't have to grow your hair longer as many women do. You don't have to put on makeup as many women do. And the department resolved that question by saying it is an internal sense. So you don't have to have done any of these things in order to take advantage of the gender identity non-discrimination protections. You don't have to go to a doctor. You don't have to get hormone treatments. You don't have to get surgery. You don't have to get your birth certificate changed. You don't have to dress like the opposite sex. It really is just what the person says. And there's no, I don't discern in what the department has said any basis for a school to say, we reject that. Come on, you were, you know, this is not what you were saying yesterday, and is it going to be what you say tomorrow? My sense is that those kinds of inquiries are not acceptable in the eyes of the department.
Well, thanks for answering that question. Back to before I ask the question, you were going to share with us more about where to go from here.
Yeah, so, you know, what do you do about this? I'm obviously not, I hope it's obvious, I would not advise you to accept all of these things. If you're already subject to Title IX, probably by participation in the National School Lunch Program or E-Rate, I would not advise, although you might consider it, to just drop out of those programs. What I would instead advise is to, number one, keep your current practices as they are. Make sure that you've made it clear that your views on these issues are rooted in your religious beliefs, a Christian anthropology about the nature of creation, about how the fall does affect and create gender dysphoria, but that you're not, as a religious matter, going to accommodate every wish that such a person might make. So those are the things I'm not really advising you to do. I would advise you to stay the course, but the legal thing that is available to you is to seek the religious exemption from Title IX from the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. But to seek this exemption essentially is a letter from the leader of the school saying that compliance with certain applications, manifestations, interpretations of Title IX would be inconsistent with our religious beliefs. You explain a little bit about that, and then you say, because of that, we would like an exemption from Title IX as you understand it. And one of the issues that has come up is whether independent non-denominational schools are eligible for the exemption, just because of the way that there's a kind of a quirk in the drafting of the religious exemption. Obviously, all of your institutions don't have to worry about that, so I think that's a non-issue for them. The only question is, I've heard some say that you shouldn't do this, and the reason is that the exemption can be, at least now, can be asserted for the first time defensively in response to a complaint. So the theory is, look, we're just going to lay low. We're not going to say anything about this. We're not going to sort of expose ourselves. We're not going to reveal to the world that we've sought this exemption, which a lot of people are unhappy about. We're just going to wait. And if and when we ever have a Title IX charge on this basis, which is probably never statistically, but you never know, we'll just assert the exemption then. What I want to say is that is a plausible and reasonable course of action. I would be inclined to recommend otherwise. I do think it is more prudent and safer to go ahead and seek the exemption, because I'm concerned that the department's practice of allowing schools to assert the exemption for the first time defensively in response to a complaint may not hold up. They're very concerned about families and students getting sandbagged, about not knowing things in advance, and the Title IX letter is just yet another way how that school reveals that it has these particular views on gender. But it's a rational debate that people have.
Yeah, thank you for that, Greg. I think that is something I think that the whole Synod is wrestling with. The Concordia University system, as I kind of understand, has wrestled with that question about for exemption for Title IX for a very long time, whether or not that is something that any of those schools wanted to do. Would that draw more attention to them? Would that draw limelight to them in an unhelpful way? I don't know all the details, but my understanding is that one of the universities is now at least making the initial application for the exemption from Title IX to just see how that goes. I don't know if they've done that. I'm not sure that it's happening, but I know there's been a lot of wrestling. So when you say, Greg, that this is something that maybe more of our schools should think about, high schools, elementary schools, that's who you're talking about. I think for us, that's sort of that opens up a whole other dynamic here just of how we would help our schools go about doing that. But it's very helpful to hear that you think that, in the midst of a defense, when there's a case against you, sort of going to it then is maybe not going to be helpful if you've not proactively sought the exemption from Title IX when there are no issues, if I understand what you're saying.
Right, right. And I that is the way it is right now. I've been involved in two, now three, complaints under Title IX. And in the first two, the school asserted the exemption, for the first time in response to the complaint, and the department accepted that. I'm working with a third school. All these are at the higher ed level, by the way. I'm working with a third school right now that has been hit with a Title IX charge, actually multiple Title IX charges, and they are asserting their exemption for the first time, and we're waiting to see how the department responds to it. So I don't want to overstate things. I think it's a reasonable position to just wait, but in my mind, on balance, it's better to seek the exemption now. And maybe even we can explore the possibility of the LCMS schools seeking it together.
Yes.
That would be great. Historically, the OCR, the Office for Civil Rights, has not been particularly embracing of that view, but it may be worth a try. And gosh, the bigger number, the harder it is to put a spotlight on any one school.
Well, and that was my question. Could we do this when you start talking about elementary schools and high schools? Is there a way for a group exemption of LCMS schools from Title IX? And how would we begin to navigate those waters?
Yeah, my view is that we should try it. And, you know, this is ADF has helped a large number of schools. I think it's over 100 now that we've at least had a conversation with about the Title IX exemption. So we've gotten pretty familiar with the process. I think, you know, it's something that you all should consider, and we should explore whether the OCR would be willing to grant a group exemption. Gosh, it would make it a lot easier than doing 2,068, I think is the number that you gave earlier.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Greg, one more question. Maybe you could just flesh out. I know we're coming to the end of the first hour. You encourage those schools not to stop receiving their Title IX money. A lot of information that we get, say, it's not a whole lot of money. We need to cut ties completely. The best thing we could do is stop taking the lunch program money or the other program money. But you've sort of cautioned against that. Could you unpack that a little bit more about why you want to see parochial or Lutheran schools continue to receive those dollars?
Yeah, it is an individual decision, and what I think it's premature to essentially wave the white flag and surrender on this. I mean, everybody has a different tolerance for risk, but, you know, there's a reason why you're participating in those programs. It's because they provide resources that are monetarily valuable to you or valuable to you in some other way. And I think given the state of the law, given the availability of the religious exemption, I personally think it's an overreaction to just say, forget it, we're not going to participate in these programs. But I'm not suggesting it's unreasonable for someone to take the contrary position and say, look, we just don't want to go down this road. It really isn't that much money. We don't want this headache. That's reasonable, too. I was just coming at it from the sort of the risk-benefit perspective. I think, there's a reason why you participate, and I think the risk is relatively low if you pursue the exemption.
Right. And the issue with the federal hot lunch program is in many of our schools that are serving urban and underserved areas, that participation allows children to receive meals, breakfast and lunch, at no cost, little or no cost. And that is a tremendous benefit for our schools that are working in underserved areas.
Anything else you'd like to share about the about schools that are asking this question? Should we just not go down this path at all with government funds, or if we're in that seat, you know, if we're already receiving funds for school lunches, that sort of thing? Anything else on that topic?
Well, I would be skeptical about entering into a new relationship that you're very dependent upon. Mm-hmm. I doubt that's even going to be available to K-12 schools. There's not a lot of new K-12 school choice programs being adopted in the states. I mean, the problem with the higher educational institutions is that they're very dependent on this federal money. And I think if they could turn the clock back, they might decline to start participating in the program. So I wouldn't participate in a new program that makes you very dependent upon the government. If it's a relatively small program, you should probably do it, unless there's a legal obstacle to doing so. But I hope that's helpful advice.
Before we get into other issues such as Title VII, Greg, anything else about Title IX that you'd like to address before we go on to Title VII?
Well, it bears noting that this is not just a hypothetical problem. Many of your listeners may know that there's a Wisconsin Synod Lutheran school in Wisconsin that has been hit with a charge of discrimination under Title IX. based on a claim of gender identity discrimination. It's actually not an individual student that experienced something that they didn't agree with. It was an activist organization called the Freedom From Religion Foundation that heard about a letter that the principal circulated, basically setting forth the school's views on these controversial issues of marriage, sexuality, and gender. And this activist organization didn't like that and thought it was inappropriate for a school that's receiving some federal benefits through the school lunch program to simultaneously receive those benefits and, quote, so-called discriminate. So according to the latest press accounts, the school itself has not received the complaint, but if they do get the complaint and it goes to the Department of Education, they actually filed it in the wrong place. If it makes its way there, it seems to me that one of the things that the school would consider doing is to assert that religious exemption. So I raise that story just to illustrate that this is not a hypothetical future thing, but it's a real thing that's happening now.
Questions, gentlemen, here regarding...
Maybe one other case. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a Wisconsin Synod school, but Greg, do you want to make any comment on our LCMS school? We have the Columbia versus Pauley that's on the docket to be heard by the Supreme Court. It's not the first time the LCMS and a LCMS school, the Hosanna Taylor case, has found itself in recent years before the Supreme Court. But Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia and their playground issue, is there any helpful information to share with folks about that situation and that case that's pending?
Yeah, it's a fascinating and terrific case, and I'm glad that an LCMS school is sort of the carrier of this issue to the Supreme Court. When I first started doing religious liberty work back in the mid-1990s, the issue that's presented in the Trinity Lutheran case versus Pauley is the kind of issue that I was confronting all the time. Over time, things have switched to all this non-discrimination stuff and associational freedom. So in a sense, this feels like an old-school Supreme Court religious liberty fight. But it does have a twist. Let me explain what's going on there for the listeners who aren't familiar with the case. The state of Missouri has a very fine program where it kind of kills two birds with one stone. It collects old used tires that would otherwise end up in landfills, and shreds them and produces this sort of meltable, pourable rubber that is poured into the surfaces of playgrounds to make those playgrounds safer for children. And they have obviously a limited amount of rubber, so they take applications. A lot of schools, daycare centers, public and private, and all of the rest. Well, Trinity Lutheran in Missouri filed an application, and they, whatever criteria the state used, they were high enough on the list to be one of the scheduled recipients of this protective playground rubberized material. But they never got the rubber for their playground. The state said, hold the phone. We believe that as a matter of church-state separation, we cannot give you this rubber. Why is that? Because it's a church that operates this school, and we believe that it's legally impermissible for the government to directly fund a house of worship. Now, you know, that's a view that's been around for a long time. Back in the earliest days of our country, there was a backlash and outrage about the government taxing people to pay ministers' salaries. And I think it was appropriate when the states disestablished their churches and stopped paying ministers' salary. I think that's been good for the state and good for the church. But the question is whether the good principle that animated those decisions means that you have to punish Trinity Lutheran School in Missouri, that you have to discriminate against them, that you have to deny them some benefit that really, you know, can't be diverted to an inherently religious use. So the interesting thing about this case, among other interesting things, is that the state is not saying that the federal establishment clause, it sometimes characterizes separation of church and state, which is not what it says, but they're not saying that the First Amendment requires them to discriminate against this church. Instead, they're saying that state law requires this. A state constitutional provision requires this. What did the school say in response? The school said, okay, whatever, maybe so, but you cannot discriminate against us just because we're religious. without violating another piece of the federal First Amendment, the Free Exercise Clause. So it's kind of a battle of competing legal principles. The facts of the case are sort of really good for our side of it. It's, you know, it's really, does it make sense to deny safety for students whose playground happens to be connected with a church? I don't think so. So it's a fascinating question, but it identifies one of the other obstacles that sometimes come up when religious entities try to interact with government. The first one we talked about yesterday, the non-discrimination rules. The second one can be this, hey, we're not going to allow you to participate in this program because it would violate separation of church and state.
Gentlemen, any other thoughts on Trinity and Columbia?
No, I think it's great for our listeners to just have a little update on what's happening, particularly I think with our Wisconsin Synod school there. In Baraboo, and we'll be curious to see how that progresses. I think a lot of LCMS schools are looking at that because that's touching on the very issue that they're most fearful of, this entanglement under Title IX and theological positions on gender, sexuality, marriage, and accepting those federal dollars and then that intersection.
Greg, during one of the breaks, you mentioned Title VII being an important issue that we should address. What is Title VII about?
So, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is one of the most significant pieces of legislation in our history, certainly the most significant piece of civil rights legislation. It has a series of titles, and these titles or sections, groups of provisions, address different contexts. You know, there's one about public accommodations, restaurants and hotels. There's some about schools. But there's one about employment, and that's Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it says to covered employers, which is basically anybody that has 15 or more employees, that you can't discriminate on the basis of a series of protected characteristics, including sex and religion. This law has been mostly not problematic for religious institutions. Obviously, schools like yours take religion into account in their hiring decisions, but the religious exemption in Title VII protects their freedom to do that. I have no doubt in my mind that all of your schools are sufficiently religious to qualify for this religious exemption. And I suspect that not many of them have experienced a problem where someone goes to the EEOC and says, I was discriminated against on the basis of religion, because that claim is not going to succeed because of that religious exemption. But I mentioned a minute ago that religion is not the only protected characteristic in Title VII. In addition to race and national origin, the word sex is in there. Well, that used to not be much of a problem either until the federal government collectively and the EEOC specifically started saying what the Department of Education said in the Title IX context, which is that the word sex in Title VII includes gender identity. So if you ask the federal government today, does Title VII ban gender identity and sexual orientation discrimination, their answer would be yes. Now, this is really ironic, I think, because there's been an effort in Congress to amend Title VII to explicitly add sexual orientation and gender identity that's been going on really since the mid-90s, and that has never succeeded. Of course, the premise of all of those efforts was that Title VII needed to be amended, that it didn't already ban sexual orientation, gender identity discrimination. But the EEOC's view, just like the Department of Education's view, is that word sex, it's always been there, and really there's always been a sexual orientation, gender identity, non-discrimination ban that we're just now sort of discovering. All right, so suppose that's right. The question then is, am I, as a religious school, subject to that ban? Which is a different way of asking the question, does the religious exemption that's already in the statute, that's been in there since the beginning, does that protect me from claims of sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination, or does it only protect me from claims of religious discrimination? The answer to that question is, we don't know. It's a debated question. There are plausible arguments on both sides of the question. I happen to think that the religious exemption is available in response to a SOGI, sexual orientation, gender identity, claim in the employment context under Title VII, because you can't divide religion between doctrine and a list of beliefs and the moral practices that are associated with that religion. Folks on the other side of these issues like to do that. They want the exemption to be narrow. They want maximum non-discrimination protection for sexual minorities. But I think the better reading of the law is that, yes, the religious exemption protects you. We don't really have a lot of case law, certainly not on this particular question yet, and I suspect that some judges will decide it one way and other judges will decide it the other way. It's an open question right now, but I, in terms of my advice, I would not advise schools to simply say, well, we think we're bound by this newly interpreted ban on SOGI discrimination, so I'm going to stop having those sorts of criteria in my for my employees. I would not do that. I think that's unnecessary.
We've talked about this a little bit, that we have faced questions about employment in the past, right, with the Hosanna Tabor case. How would this be different when it comes to, as you said, SOGI claims?
Yeah, the thing about Hosanna Tabor is that it's very powerful, but very narrow. It's powerful in the sense that the doctrine the Supreme Court embraced and articulated in that case essentially protects a school from almost any kind of employment-based claims. But the scope of that protection in terms of which employees it applies to is relatively narrow. As I'm sure most of your listeners know, the doctrine at issue in that case was the ministerial exception. How big is it? What do you need to do to successfully invoke it? And I think the most significant question is, who counts as a minister? And that's the answer to that question is sort of a gray, it's a gray, blurry-lined category. Now, the good thing is that the Supreme Court seems to take the view that it's a broader category than one might expect. It would have been disappointing if the court had said only those people who are ordained and perform sacerdotal functions and preach and administer the sacraments and all of that, those are the only people to whom this ministerial exception applies. That's not what they said. They said that the exception was available in the case of a teacher who was a commissioned teacher who had a certain amount of theological training that was necessary for her position, that prayed with students. There was sort of just enough there for her to qualify as a minister. So I think certainly the ministerial exception would be available in some cases of Title VII SOGI discrimination claims, but not in all of them and probably not in most of them.
So, Greg, do you give us any advice around hiring practices and vetting employees that would be different now with this sort of ambiguity of Title VII?
No, I would not change it at all. If I were to change it, I would, you know, do the things that we've already been recommending, which is to be clear and to root your views about gender identity and homosexuality clearly in your religious convictions. Cite scripture, cite church documents, cite things that make this, that reflect the true reality that this is a manifestation of your religious belief and not just some sort of animus or bigotry towards gay and lesbian and transgender people. That will help as we make the argument that the religious exemption is available in this context. It'll also help us make kind of the backup argument if that doesn't work. I would argue that in many circumstances, if the government punishes you for taking adverse action against an employee who engages in behavior contrary to your faith, that violates your religious freedom. And it not only is protected by this exemption in Title VII, but it violates rights that you have under the First Amendment and under the federal religious freedom statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So I think the advice is consistent with what we've been saying before, but it gives you just yet another reason to make sure that you do this and connect it up with your religious beliefs.
Greg, maybe just to make this practical, we can put all these things in place, but it doesn't mean any of our schools are going to be immune from lawsuits or, you know, being spoken ill of within their communities. So what happens when that actually takes place, when a school is being sort of legally challenged or it's happening, it's spreading in the community? What kind of actual steps should schools take when they find themselves maybe sort of like St. John's in Baraboo, Wisconsin? They haven't received anything yet, but that's certainly been out in the news. What do schools actually do?
Yeah, I think these days you have to make two responses. One is a legal response and one is sort of a public advocacy response. There are plenty of circumstances where the law is on the side of the institution, but they get clobbered in the court of public opinion and capitulate because of that. So I think, number on the legal side of it, contacting a qualified attorney early on to help is an important step. It's always a shame when the lawyer gets called after the mess has already been made. Don't be afraid to call soon. And, the local attorneys that your schools work with, the resources that are inside the LCMS and ADF, were all resources that are available to you if something comes up. And it just positions you. I mean, we've seen enough of these that there's certain patterns and there's certain things that you can do to kind of diminish the possibility that the thing will blow up. So, again, we encourage that. On the public advocacy side, you know, there's this temptation to just say no comment. And that, I think, is counterproductive. You know, we live in a world where there are plenty of media outlets. The Internet is endless. And I think that there's a way that we can get out our positive message, that we can frame the controversy in a way that's not provocative, that's not inflammatory, that's not hateful, but instead explains who we are and why we do what we do in as loving and winsome way as possible. But I don't think it's a good option to just, we'll lay low and let the other side frame the issue and offer its facts without rebuttal. So I would advise both those things if these sort of controversies arise.
And I think that's exceptional. I think our listeners should be very aware of the fact that for our schools, whatever level they are, when these issues come up, both legally and in the court of public opinion, to let us know at the Synod headquarters. We have Synod Legal Counsel. We network with all of these other organizations like ADF. So, I mean, we are here to try to help schools in the midst of those legal entanglements. But likewise, we have professional communication staff here. We understand crisis communication management. We help congregations and schools and districts with those things also. So, you know, please don't feel yourself all alone on an island if and when these issues come to your back door. Please let us know. The Synod wants to be a helpful resource and advocate in any and all ways that we can. We have pledged to stand with our schools in the midst of these issues so that they can remain faithful and true to the gospel and educating the children of the world. So we're here for you. Please let us help you.
I would just urge schools, when challenged, to take the first step in going to their district and advising their district
absolutely
that they have been challenged. Then we're happy to be brought into this situation, but start at the district level. A lot of districts have legal representation that is available to them and can advise and assist at that level. But we also want to know. So districts and national level stand behind your schools in supporting you in the right of religious freedom.
Greg, earlier, I think we were still talking about Title IX at the time, but you used a phrase that caught my attention. I believe you said that our schools are sufficiently religious. What does that term mean? What do you mean by sufficiently religious?
Yeah, you know, Title VII says that essentially religious organizations, associations, societies, corporations are exempt. Well, that, you know, it kind of begs the question, what counts? as a religious association. What counts as a religious society or corporation? And over time, Congress didn't say, by the way. So the courts over time have sort of fleshed out what those words mean. And I think they've come up with a pretty generous, inclusive test. I think one thing is nonprofit status is certainly a very important attribute of an exempt religious organization. And by the way, I think it's important to clarify that our conversation right now is just about federal Title VII, its religious exemption. It's very important to note that almost all states and many municipalities, counties, cities have their own non-discrimination ordinances, and they have their own religious exemptions, some of which are narrower than the relatively broad federal exemption. So I don't want this to be taken as a discussion of all of these non-discrimination rules. But the courts and the EEOC have said, you know, what is your function? What do you do? I mean, if you're producing a secular product, you're probably not going to be a religious employer. If you're for profit, you're probably not going to be. I think the boundary cases are so kind of far away from what your schools are and what they do. You know, they're connected with a church, they're doing education, they're nonprofit, they incorporate religious faith into the curriculum. The fact that they actually hire based on faith is actually a helpful thing in invoking the exemption. It demonstrates the seriousness of your religious convictions. But I think this is, at least at the federal level, it's mostly a non-issue. It's like you're so within the boundary lines as, you know, K-12, LCMS, religious schools, that it's not something I worry about. I do sometimes worry about state exemptions, and I obviously can't speak to all 50 of those in the time that we have left, even if I knew all the details, which I don't.
I was just curious if it meant we had to, you know, cover a certain amount of scripture in when you're seeing a certain number of hymns in order to be sufficiently religious. With just a few minutes left, about 4 minutes left, 3 or 4 minutes left, what do you think is the outlook for Christian schools, particularly for Lutheran schools? What do you think the outlook is for us for the next decade or so?
Yeah, I worry that we're going to go through some troubled times. The folks on the other side of these issues are very clear in what they think and what they want. What they think is that those of us who believe that homosexual behavior is wrong, those of us who believe that responding to gender dysphoria with chemicals and surgery and cross-dressing, they think that those of us who believe that those things are wrong are the functional equivalent of racists, of people who think that African Americans are somehow inferior to white people. That is what animates them. That is what many of them either believe or at least say they believe, because it's a useful device to get what they want. If that's true, think about how the law and the culture treat racists, and I think appropriately so. It marginalizes and punishes, which in that case I think is absolutely right. But I think we need to maintain this distinction. I think many people in America, even if they support gay rights and same-sex marriage, I think they still believe that there is an important difference between a religious body saying, you know what, in our church we just do traditional marriage, we don't do opposite sex, or we don't do same-sex marriage. I think a lot of people still believe that, and we need to make sure that that's still true. So the folks on the other side have said what they believe. They've also said what they want. And what they want is they want no benefits from the government to be available to a religious entity that, quote, discriminates on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. These things that we've talked about in Title VII and Title IX are not the only contexts where this is occurring. You know, the federal contractor executive order that the president signed, things going on at the state level, show this wave of trying to shrink or eliminate religious exemptions. There's a bill pending in the Congress. It's probably not going to go anywhere, but it does reflect, I think, the radical and extreme nature of the people on the other side. They want to amend the Civil Rights Act to add sexual orientation and gender identity. There will be, in most contexts, non-existent exemptions. they will partially repeal the Religious Freedom Restoration Act so that religious organizations can't invoke their rights under that in defense of these new statutes. So I think that we're in for some difficult times, and there may be choices. We may, at the end of the day, have to make choices about whether we're going to maintain who we are or whether we're going to maintain receipt of a government benefit. And I think K through 12 schools are much less vulnerable because of the relatively the small amounts of government money that they get. It's a lot easier for you all than for, you know, say, the Concordia system that depends on student aid that comes from the federal level. But, you know, I do have hope. There are lots of people who are willing to adhere to biblical truths about marriage. I think that's been very encouraging to me. And if we don't capitulate, I think that we can get through this and get through it together and be a good witness for Christ and his gospel.
Bart, earlier, I believe it was in yesterday's program, you mentioned a resource available to churches and schools. Can you remind us and how to get our hands on that resource?
Sure. Protecting Your Ministry, that's been co-branded by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and ADF. That will be mailed in the middle of July to every congregation and every school of the Synod. ADF will be at the Synod Convention and will have hard copies also available. And I believe after the mailing goes out, we're going to make that available on the Synod website to be downloaded. And again, it should be a very helpful resource in giving you some statements of faith, some things about employment and facility usage policies. So please keep an eye out for that document. People have been asking about it. We've been working very hard with ADF to bring that to fruition.
We're very grateful for our partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. Greg Baylor, Senior Counsel, Director of Center for Religious Schools, Alliance Defending Freedom. Greg, thanks for being our guest today on Faith and Family.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Terry Schmidt, Director of School Ministry, LCMS Office of National Mission. Terry, thanks for being my guest.
Thanks for this opportunity, and thank you very much, Greg.
And Reverend Bart Day, Director of LCMS Office of National Mission, thanks for being my guest.
My pleasure.
This concludes our two-part program on the issues that schools are facing today.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at kfuo.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.